Hi, I'm Jeremy Kirk with Intel 471, and welcome to another edition of Studio 471, which is our ongoing discussion series about information security. So, say that you're a buyer of security technologies for a big company, and you want to ensure that the vendor's product does what the vendor is claiming it to do. This is where security testing comes in. And over the years, this has been a really contentious area. A lot of vendors have been sparring over the results, and there's been accusations of cheating. So today we're going to dig into what security testing is and what is ethical security testing and break it down and how this can show value for your organization. So my guest today is Simon Edwards, who's the CEO and founder of SE Labs in the UK. Thank you very much for joining me, Simon.
Hi, Jeremy. It's lovely to see you again.
So, just for full disclosure, before we get into this, Simon is a mate of mine. We were both security journalists in London, in another time and place.
A long time ago.
But why don't, for the benefit of everyone else, why don't you tell me about your background and then how you got into security testing?
Well, the very short version of the story is that I was working on computer magazines, same as you were in London. Things like Computer Shopper magazine and Mac User. And in those days, we wouldn't just cover news, we would test things as well. So you could be testing large monitors or color printers or whatever. And antivirus was one of the things I got interested in testing, and it developed from there. So basically, the industry came to me and said, "We think you could actually do this commercially, because the way that you test is a bit better than the way that established testers are doing things." And it grew from there. And it became more about what the hackers are doing rather than the general spammy malware that affects everybody. And so we now focus on targeted attacks more than anything else. And for that, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, getting a handle on the threat intelligence is completely crucial. Because if you're going to test if a security product can do something good or useful, you have to know what the bad guys are going to do as well.
Yeah, exactly. And so what are your goals in kind of setting this up, and what type of people are working there now? And then we'll get into the testing methodology, which is super interesting.
Well, the goals are to try and make products better, because at the end of the day, it's us versus them. There are bad people trying to take away our resources and make lives harder. So we want to be useful to two different groups of people, I suppose. The people making the security products and the people buying them. I want you guys who are buying products to make sound choices and to make sure that you are as secure as you can be. There's more to it than buying products, of course, but you've got to make sure you've got good ones to begin with. And when you do produce these products, good testing can help. And if we find there are problems, rather than just putting you at the bottom of a ranking and saying, "Oh, there are better things out there," we can actually help those companies fix the problems, because it isn't properly rocket science. So there's lots of different approaches you can take. But at the end of the day, if we can find a way through, we can also explain that there's a way through, and then the clever people that make these products can fix it. So that's our main goal, is to try and make things more secure for everyone. And then the way that we do that, the team that we have, we don't automate a great deal. We basically are just good hackers, and we behave the same way or as close as we can to the actual criminals. And that means that we can hack through the systems that we're testing. We hack our own computers, essentially. So it's a little bit like a penetration test, but not really. And then we can say, "Right, this firewall saw all these threats coming through, but it didn't see these ones," or "This antivirus, this anti-malware product saw these particular things running, but it didn't stop them," or it did. There's so many layers that you can look at.
And so you replicate the cyber kill chain, of course, which is the sort of famous model for when attackers begin just looking at systems through the reconnaissance phase, through weaponization, through delivery, finally ex you have exploitation, installation, you'll have like lateral movement in there, command and control, and then through the end, through like sort of the full compromise. So tell me how you emulate that sort of how you test a product against all of those phases, and then how do you judge the results?
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned malware earlier, and that is often an important part of an attack, but it's just one little chunk of it. And so, if you and I were to sit down and to make a security product, we might decide that phishing is where most of the attacks come from. So if we can nail the anti-phishing bit, and maybe have some antivirus stuff a bit further down to catch the things that come through, then we could probably stop a lot of the threats. So you can't, as testers, you can't assume that the vendors are going to completely cover one security layer. We've got to test all the way through, like you say. Now, we're very grateful to MITRE for producing the attack framework, which is a really good way of explaining how targeted attacks work and how that full attack chain looks. And by using that framework, what you can do is you can say, right, well, what does the attack look like from the very beginning through to the very end? Is it a phishing attack? Is it a link to a bad website in that phishing email? That website will have a reputation, so there's a chance there for a product to block that URL, for example. And then you work your way all the way through, and you look at what the bad guys do in real life. So there's lots of reports out there. Some are more public than others, and you can say, right, well, this group behaves like this. They generally phish. They generally use these different techniques to dig down deeper into the system. Maybe they use keyloggers to steal passwords, or they use other ways to pull out credentials. And maybe they always move from the initial systems to other systems using certain techniques. And by knowing all of those different things, you can kind of come up with a menu of how to behave like different attack groups. And in fact, we have that on our website. If companies want to work with us, we say, well, which targeted attacks should we use for this? We've got a whole list of different groups that we can pretend to be. And by doing that, and by produce, we do make threats as well, but using the same kind of tools that the bad guys use as well. So it's very, very close to what like the FSB are doing, or the Chinese, or whoever.
Yeah,
And
I
then we
think I
just
heard
sit.
you.
And
Oh,
so,
sorry. I think
sorry,
I
go
heard
ahead.
you describe in your podcast recently. You could emulate the attack that occurred against the Democratic, National Committee in 2016, which I think was a lot of sort of phishing-based stuff. But that's interesting. So your clients can actually pick a, like, I want to try this. I don't know, maybe a, I don't know, malware in actually in a in a in an email rather than like a link to something else, like actual like malware, just like a macro, we'll say, like it's something that's pretended to, masked in a macro document or something like that.
Yeah, I mean they would generally choose the group. So if say we're testing a firewall or a network detection and response product, we would probably advise using attack groups which are noisier on the network, because then it gives the product a chance to demonstrate its abilities. Whereas if we're testing an endpoint product, we might want something that does lots of really clever stuff on the endpoint, which can be detected. If you do that kind of attack with a firewall, it still works and it should still detect the stuff coming and going, but there's an awful lot of stuff going on which it wouldn't have any insight into, unless it's part of an XDR type of product. So it's less about kind of tuning the test for the product and more about efficiency. You know, what is most useful when we come to test a firewall or an endpoint or an email service, because we can test security services as well in the cloud.
And then tell me, how does threat intelligence enter in this? So there's lots of different threat feeds out there with indicators of compromise that can be pushed to SIEMs, that can be pushed directly to endpoints these days. How does that enter into testing when, I guess, somebody orders a test? And do you actually like also simulate or actually use the threat intelligence that they would have had access to, that the products would have been updated with?
Well, we don't know how they've updated the product. We approach this with sort of zero knowledge of the product. We say to them, install it like you would with any other client. We're just going to pretend to be a dumb client who's going to put it in our network and hope it protects us. And then we get the red team in, which is also us, and they start doing the attacks. And then we see what the product sees. We use the threat intelligence to make sure that what we're doing does represent what the real bad guys do. And if the product is set up properly, has all the right updates, then it should detect what we're doing. They've got to remember that in the old days with antivirus, a lot of it was based on signatures. So that is a kind of indicator of compromise, a hash of a file or something. And the bad guys got around that by making their malware polymorphic, for example. It would look different every time, even though it was essentially the same. And vendors would go, oh, there's 20 billion different pieces of malware out there, when actually there's only a few hundred, but there's lots of different variations of them. So lost the thread a little bit there. But essentially, we use threat intelligence to make sure that the way we test is as close as possible to how the bad guys work. And then it's up to the vendors to make sure that their products detect that and maybe prevent that. And by doing that, when you see that we've done a review of a product and we say that it's good, that should mean as a customer, you're getting something that actually will work. And because we do variations, we don't take stuff off WikiLeaks or whatever and just copy them directly. It does indicate that if the product can stop us doing a variation of the dragonfly attack group, then it probably would stop future dragonfly, similar dragonfly attacks as well, because it's looking at the behaviors, not the very specific IOCs that would be quite easy just to copy.
Gotcha. And I was going to ask, like, sort of, fileless malware or also living off the land binaries, using tools that are native to the operating system like PowerShell. How are security technologies coping with that? And then how do you, I guess, do you test that as well?
Yeah, is that's really hard for them, because if you're using something like PowerShell to mess with a system, it's a systems administration tool. It should be there for a lot of companies, so you can't just say to the product block it. What you can do is to say block it for Simon and Jeremy, because they shouldn't be messing with the systems, but only
Yes.
allow a very specific group to use them. But yeah, that's where behavioral detection comes in as well. And what we're seeing is a shift into detecting anomalies. Now, this kind of approach has been around for ages, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's been done very well for a long time. And the idea is that maybe Jeremy is allowed to use PowerShell, but when we see him logging in from China at 3 o'clock in the morning regularly and doing things like that, that kind of sets off a few red flags. And of course, if you use multi-factor authentication, all sorts of other things to kind of mitigate the risk, you start seeing it being used in different ways, and that should alert the SOC. Maybe something automated can block you from doing that, or maybe they can even roll back some of the changes that you've made. But watching unusual behavior and acting on that, I think, is what people are trying to use to get past this problem. And this is where they would get excited about AI and machine learning, because, not to drift off on too much of a tangent here, Jeremy, but AI and ML has been used in security to sell products for ages.
Absolutely, yeah.
But it's not what people think it is. What it is really good at is spotting patterns, and spotting anomalous behavior actually is quite a good use case for those kind of technologies.
And do you see that? Do you see true AI in security products at all? Or what's your prediction, at least, for how this is going to manifest, I guess, beyond, what we already know of, like, pattern matching and, again, looking at abnormal events, doing baseline behavioral monitoring, modeling, and then finding those anomalous events and alerting on them.
I think that one of the biggest challenges that you've got isn't actually detecting the threats. It's putting them together into useful groups where humans or technology can act on them. So I'll give you a real example of this. A very popular security product from quite a few years ago. It came out, it said it was the newest, biggest, greatest thing. And when you had a ransomware attack, it wouldn't say, oh, there's been a ransomware attack. It generated an alert for every single file that got encrypted. So if you're working in the SOC and you come to a screen in the morning and it's all red and you think, oh my God, I've had loads and loads of attacks here. It's actually maybe only a couple of attacks, but they're alerting on every single negative element of that attack. So triaging attacks, putting different events together into groups and saying, right, this is the thing we have to handle this morning. This can wait. Here's a button to press to quarantine a system that's been ransomware and is starting to try and attack other systems. That is a bit of a holy grail, as far as I can see. And that is the kind of thing that I think AI would be able to help with, because all the bits of information are there. We know where the attacks come from, we know what's happened. So long as the products can see what's going on and feed that information back to a brain that can put it all together into a coherent story that humans can use to protect themselves, I think that is probably the most realistic hope for AI in cybersecurity.
I'm curious when people come to you and want to do these tests or want to see the results at least of it, what kind of questions do you get asked? Is it just kind of like, and is it as a result of like we've had an attack and now we're in a bind and we're angry at our former vendor for not detecting this sort of event? Or is it, and it also does it differ by size? Like, are some security products better for your size or your market vertical or your particular circumstances than others?
That's an interesting question. So there are two kinds of customers that we have, the people that buy the products and the people that make them. So the ones that buy the products, one of the most common questions they have is, can we change from what we're using to something else, spend less money and get more protection? So for example, Microsoft, has become a lot better than it used to be. And a lot of their security products are to a degree included in a lot of the services like Office 365 that big companies subscribe to. So their thought is, well, can we get away with just using what's included and not have to buy a whole load of licenses for three or four different products? And enterprises are always trying to simplify. They've got dozens of different security products in their networks, and they want to have fewer because managing all of that in a useful way is very, very hard. So they ask us questions like that. Not necessarily is this product better, but is it better for us? If our team is already trained on, say, Fortinet firewalls, maybe they could use Fortinet endpoint as well, and there'd be some coherence there. Where it gets more contentious is the security vendors. So we have a good reputation and relationship with lots of them, but some I would say not. And a lot of the questions they ask are based on some of our competitors or ex-competitors, where there's been some very bad behavior in the testing world, where people have kind of felt shaken down a bit, I would say. And so a lot of their questions are kind of like, how can we be sure you're not going to rip us off or make stuff up or whatever, be incompetent and
Sure.
corrupt,
Yeah.
which is, I mean, it's quite good in a way. It starts us off on a back foot because we have to kind of prove we're not going to be awful. But on the other hand, once you do show that you're going to be useful, everyone gets very relieved and happy, and it's almost a moment of celebration. The bar was very low for security testing a few years ago. Just behaving like decent people was put you up in the top 5%.
Right. I think you're very transparent too about the way that you do it as well. And that's quite important. It's like, here's exactly how we do it. Here's the sample. Here's the whole thing, where I think in the past there was a certain amount of obfuscation and kind of I wouldn't say like misdirection necessarily, but just opacity, I guess, around some of the processes that were used, and that kind of really ramped up tensions.
I've got an anecdote for you, if you'd like.
Sure.
Okay, this is one of the big endpoint companies, and they had used this other tester, which doesn't exist anymore. And the problem that a lot of people had with this group was they would give you bad results, and then they wouldn't share the information to help make things better. So they would say, "You've missed all of this malware," and the vendor would say, "Well, okay, got it. Thank you. Can you share the files so we can at least provide coverage for our customers?" And they would say, "No, there's some intellectual property issue with this." And eventually they would like get some files off them, and it would turn out to be a Skype installer or something that wasn't malware. So they would say, "Well, this don't criticize us for not detecting this because it's not malware." And they go, "All right then," and change the result. So we're working in an environment where people are expecting this kind of bad behavior. And we did a test for this company, and they missed quite a lot of our targeted attacks. And they asked for the samples, and we provided them straight away. And this guy phoned me up, and he said, "Simon, I'm so disappointed. We thought you guys were better than this." And I was like, "What's happened?" And he said, "You've just given us, we're looking for malware here, and you've given us a load of Microsoft Systems internals tools, like Process Monitor and all those things." And I said, "Well, yes, that's certainly what they look like. And if you run them, you will have Process Monitor running, but you'll also have a backdoor to our system, or we'll have a backdoor to your systems, and we'll be able to remote control your computers." And he said, "Well, how did you do that?" And we taught him the technique and the tools that we used to do that. And they were like, "Ah, thank you very much for helping us improve our product." But from that story, what we can see is not only can we help by copying the bad guys, but there is an assumption that testing is incompetent. The first thought was these guys have made a mistake, not
Yes.
they found a clever way around our product.
Yes, interesting. I wanted to ask you about identity because a lot of people have referred to identity as the new perimeter. Most organizations use single sign-on, so if you can get those credentials and potentially find a way around MFA, if MFA is implemented, you could get access to a lot of internal resources. Are you able to test for identity-based attacks and credential attacks, those sorts of things, since that is such a huge vector for how malicious actors end up on systems?
Yes, and that this comes down to, I think, the behavioral detection thing we were talking about earlier as well. So with some of the network detection products that we see, they are designed to detect unusual behavior. Now, you might say an unusual behavior could be an attack, but maybe you're being attacked all the time. So it's certain successes, I guess, from the attacker's point of view that should be unusual. And we have to do a thing called baselining there. So what that means is if we set up a network at your house, Jeremy, and we put a network detection thing in place, we have to allow a certain number of days, weeks, or even maybe months of normal behavior to happen so the firewall can learn, or the NDR can learn what normal is using its AI or ML or whatever. And then we start doing the attacks, and then it goes, ah, that's different. And this is where identity does come in, because if you log in at a certain time every day, and suddenly you're logging in at a 12-hour variance, in the middle of the night or whatever, then you would hope the product could say, this seems suspicious. So yes, so I think so long as you behave exactly like the attacker, you don't simulate anything as such, because we don't really simulate, we just do the attacks for real, then you can kind of test anything. The problem with this baselining issue is, and I know you didn't ask about baselining, but I'm just going to bring it
Sure,
up.
go ahead.
They're often designed to work in really busy networks. So if you put it into a Fortune 500 company, loads of information is going to come through it and it can start learning. But if you're testing, you have to generate quite a lot of that normal traffic to get this thing up and running. And that is a challenge, because you've got to decide what normal is, and you've got to then you are emulating a busy network. You're putting all this information through this firewall so it thinks it's actually deployed in a Fortune 500 company, when in fact it's deployed in a small security lab in Wimbledon, London.
I want to ask you too about XDR, right? Extended detection response. A lot of vendors are in this. This is like the next phase of EDR. And this is supposed to kind of encompass other sources for logs like email and identity. And I know that your company recently did a big test of EDR products. What are some of the noticeable things about those products? And are they kind of doing what they've promised to do, I guess, is to wrap all this together and get this broader picture of what's going on your network.
They can do. And I think for me, the interesting part about XDR is, what does it actually mean? And there's whole discussions in the industry about this. For me, it means you've got at least two different products working in harmony with each other. They don't have to be from the same company. So companies like Cisco and Fortinet and maybe Palo Alto, who have firewalls and they've got endpoint and they've got cloud services, they would maybe say their XDR offering is when you buy all these things from them, from one vendor. Whereas other companies, like Microsoft, for example, doesn't have a firewall. SentinelOne, which does endpoint, doesn't do anything else. They just do endpoint. So you could roll your own XDR. You could say, so long as Microsoft email talks to SentinelOne endpoint and maybe a Fortinet firewall through some other product that maybe you create, that could be an XDR as well. And I think so long as they talk to each other and inform each other, that to me is my definition of XDR. The R in XDR is response. So you don't even have to protect, so long as you've got some kind of response, which could be to log it and to put an alert up or something like that. That probably is good enough. And I always worry when the industry decides what's best for the customer. Sometimes the customer wants to watch and not to stop something happening. They don't want to tip off the bad guys, for example. So having options is always useful. But I think XDR is a really good idea. If you've got a firewall that knows about some malware that's come through, why wouldn't it then inform all the different endpoints on the network to watch out for this thing that's new but being detected?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about the automation aspect of it being appealing. So that response, being able to take an action that somebody else has just, set a rule for. But do you see that actually being used, or do you see like more people sitting back and wanting to like get the alert just to make sure that this hasn't been a false positive or something that's going to just be very disruptive?
Yeah, I have seen it happen. There are services where a firewall, like I say, will a piece of malware come through. It will deliver the malware to the endpoint because it doesn't know it's malware yet, and then it puts it up in the cloud and runs it through various different sandboxes. Then it goes, ah, that thing that Jeremy downloaded was bad. So let's see if his computer's run it yet. We can maybe stop it. But also, let's tell Simon's computer, if you see this thing, this is now known to be bad, so don't allow it to run. So that's a good use of automation. The AI ML endpoint vendors would say, ah, yes, but you've still got your initial victim. Jeremy still potentially run malware on his system.
Sure.
But yes, if you've got an onslaught of this stuff coming in, then I think it's still worth it's a bit like people talking about signatures, right? So the ML guys said you don't need signatures, just use ML because we can detect behavior. I would say if you know that this file is bad, it's a bit like having a photograph of a shoplifter in the local shop. I don't know if this guy over here is going to be a shoplifter, but I do know this guy's a shoplifter. So let's have a picture by the door so we know when he walks in that he's a bad guy. If we know these files are bad, we might as well use signatures because
Absolutely.
that definitely works. Yeah.
Not something to be solely relied upon, but it's still a technology and still a way to go, okay, well, this is known bad, and so we can just keep it as known bad.
It's a cheap way of doing it. We're not putting throwing computing cycles into looking at patterns of binaries or stuff. This file is bad. Stop it now, you know.
Yeah, exactly. So I want to talk about the conference that's coming up. So for the first time, your company is going to put on a threat intelligence conference in London. This is at the end of March.
You got some great speakers, including you.
I'm going to be there talking about my favorite subject, ransomware. Tell me more about the conference and who's going to be there and what's going to happen.
The C2 is a threat intelligence conference, and it's aimed at CISOs. So it's aimed at the people, or CISOs, but also other people who are in charge of policy. So we're not going to be looking at black screens full of green text, hexadecimal, reverse engineering binaries. There are other conferences for that. This is about security leaders from business talking to other experts in a very secure environment. We're not going to be streaming anything. You've got to be invited, basically. I think when I talk to the big business leaders, one thing that they all seem to have in common is a little bit of imposter syndrome. So they've got these huge budgets, they've got really big teams, but they still are thinking to themselves, have I missed something? Am I doing something wrong? What would I do if something happened? So getting those guys together and saying, look, we are all in this together. We're all human. You've probably got 99% of everything covered, but it'd be quite nice to know that, wouldn't it? And here's how you do the other 1%. That's the goal, really, to bring those people together.
Great. And I think we're going to have a good roundtable on ransomware, most likely. So, I mean, there's just a whole lot of things going on with ransom right now. Here in Australia, they've said that, at some point, paying a ransom will probably be illegal, which is kind of an interesting, that whole discussion is still surfacing again. We've got ransomware that's back and fiercer than ever. I mean, last year, I don't think we've completely tallied our numbers yet, but at least from all perspective, it looks like it was back in full force again, which is, this is a consistent problem of professional cyber criminal gangs holding people for ransom and causing lots of impacts to economy and healthcare systems and even outside just your sort of regular sort of businesses. So yeah, I'm looking forward to hearing the perspectives on, how executives are viewing those sorts of challenges and how they're combating them and defending against them.
Yeah, I mean that's a really great couple of debate points there. If you think back to the day, I mean, ransomware's been so useful to us, I guess, in the industry in some ways because it's such a visible threat. Is there's no doubt when you've got ransomware, and there's a money amount put on it. So when you say to the chief financial officer, "We need this budget for security because someone might steal our IP," they might go, "Well, I don't know how much that's worth." But when they say, "I want $1 million," it's like, right, we can definitely see what the value is for protection here. And then this thing about it being illegal to pay ransoms is fascinating too. I was talking to Europol just last week, and I asked them about that, and they said, "Why would we like go after the victims? That doesn't seem right. You know, if you pay a ransom, we're not going to go after you." So it's a bit like that. Do you remember in the old days, the big debate about should you counter a hack? Someone hacks you, should you hack them back? And some people thought you should, and some people thought you shouldn't. It's like, why would the law enforcement come after me, a victim, for like punching back, basically? And there are reasons, of course, and we can't go into that now. But similarly, if I've had to pay money to get my data back and keep my business alive, I'm sorry if it went to the Iranians, but I needed to keep my business alive.
One last thing before we go, Simon. You do a podcast called Decoded, which I listened to in preparation for this chat. But it's a really interesting podcast, and I was curious. So you've done a couple of seasons. It looked like there was a bit of a break last year. Are you going to come back with some more episodes? Because it was really interesting look at malware testing and current security issues.
Thank you. Yeah, we do try and cover quite a broad range, and the idea is that even CISOs are human beings with families and personal lives as well. So we want to cover not just the business stuff, but other things. And yes, so season three is in production. Really looking forward to doing it. I think it's going to be even better and more polished format than the previous episodes. So thank you for saying what you said. But I think we've still got room for improvement. But yes, season three probably out before the summer, I would say, but 2024.
Great. Well, look for it. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
DecodedCyber.com.
There you go.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Thanks a lot.